Guy James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Life! Life, you hear me? Give my creation life!
So this was fun.
You're going to like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Good countdown. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered a restricted broadcast area. You have entered a restricted broadcast area.
This is the Guy James Show. James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Guy James Show. Glad to have you along here on this Thanksgiving Eve day, I guess. I guess that's what we'd call it. Yes, tomorrow is Thanksgiving. We'll talk a little bit about that today, perhaps the history of Thanksgiving, and get a little personal about it. What do you do for Thanksgiving and all that? I would enjoy hearing your personal Thanksgiving stories, if you have any. Beautiful day here in Southwest Florida. I hate to rub it in once again, but it's one of those deals that's about 75, 76 degrees and just oh so comfy, sunny. This gets to be the time of year here where we don't have the afternoon rain every day about 4 o'clock. During the summer, you can just about count on it. 4 o'clock every afternoon, it rains for a few minutes and gets it over with. But we're getting into the dry season now, so we'll have fires and everything else here if we don't get a little bit of wet rain. Glad to have you along with us this afternoon. Not a big news-worthy day. There is a tragedy going on over in Mumbai in India. Some people think it's a terrorist activity. Somewhere around 16 to 25 people killed, I understand, so far in multiple locations. And as we hear, there are still gun battles going on back and forth between the terrorists and authorities. So we'll try and keep an eye on that, what happens there today. Tomorrow is Thanksgiving. The day after is Black Friday. Are you ready to go out and just spend on Black Friday? Are you going to go out? I see some of the stores starting at 4 o'clock in the morning, offering free gifts if you go at 4 o'clock in the morning. Some stores starting at midnight tonight. Crazy. They're going to do anything they can to get people in the store. You know, if I were you, and you were going to spend some money for Christmas this year. I'm really not going to. Can't. You know, it's one of those deals that many people just can't spend any money this year for Christmas. I've never gotten into it in a big, big way in the past decade or so anyway. But I would advise everybody to wait. Just if you're going to go out and do some shopping, wait. I think you're going to see deals like you've never seen before. Might be a good time of clothing, for example. Oh my God, some of the bargains on clothing that I've seen here in the last few months. Terrific bargains if you need to buy clothing. But that's going to be the thing. I think a lot of people this year may well go out and buy a few things, but they're going to be things they really need. I think people are going to be very, very practical this Christmas, and I don't think you're going to see anybody lining up for Cabbage Patch dolls or pet rocks or anything like that. I think you'll see very practical gifts at Christmas time this year. And Black Friday, this Friday, had better be a very successful day for a lot of merchants. If it isn't, you're going to see tons of stores closing up right after Christmas. I would bet you on that. We've got this huge slump going on right now. Probably we'll see some of the biggest discounts that you've ever seen. A lot of merchants are just fighting for their lives for this Christmas season, and many, many retailers. Actually, they're betting their survivability on having a big, big Black Friday, biggest they've ever had. I don't see how they can figure that, but I guess they're saying with some of these bargains they're going to be passing out, this just might be one of the worst shopping seasons on record. And I think that, yes, everybody's going to line up for the freebies and all that sort of thing, but I'll bet you by 10 o'clock or noon or whatever on Black Friday, I'll bet you it's over with. Betcha. And there are many, many retail outfits that depend on this 30-day season to make a profit at all. Some of them operate in the red all year long and depend on the Christmas season to make a profit. And if they don't this year, you know what's going to happen. I had a big list here. I don't know what happened to it, but lots of stores closing up around the country. I'm thinking in the women's line, for one, Talbot's. That's a big company around the country. The black and white stores are closing up. What else? I had a big long list. They're closing all their stores, from what I understand, the black and white and Talbot's. And Talbot's kind of a high-end women's store, but it was surprising to see them go out of business. They're not exactly like going to Kmart to buy your clothes. They're a little bit on the high end. But it's going to be a tough season, and not only for the merchants. It's going to be a tough season for a lot of the folks out there that have lost their jobs, have run out of unemployment, have run out of things to sell at garage sales or on eBay. It's going to be a very difficult time. So I don't know. All I know is my household this year will not be spending hardly anything for Christmas. What are you going to be doing for Thanksgiving tomorrow? We're going over to some friend's house that we usually spend Thanksgiving with, and sometimes Christmas as well. And it's interesting. I heard some columnists talking. I read some articles the columnist wrote about visiting relatives this holiday season and the inevitable conversations that come up about politics. And you know how you've had to kind of eat it from your right-wing relatives, Uncle Ralph and all that here in the past few years. You're going to get your lecture about those evil liberals and all that this year. Do you discuss it at family get-togethers? Now, where I'm going tomorrow with friends, we can discuss and will discuss politics all day long. Because everybody there is a dyed-in-the-wool, yellow-dog Democrat. Now, there won't be one. I remember one season about 4 years ago or so, there were a couple there that maybe out of the dozen people that were there, there was two that were kind of right-wing fundies, you know. And it became evident to them what they were in on there very shortly after they got there. And they kept their mouth shut when we talked about politics. And we will talk about politics all day tomorrow, I'm sure. I mean, it affects our lives so very much in every facet. And I see that Barack Obama is saying now, help is on the way. Help is on the way. He's got a big economic plan he's going to come up with, and help is on the way. God, I hope so. I hope that they can pull a rabbit out of a hat and pull off some sort of a magic trick and get us out from under this Bush economic disaster that we're living under right now. This thing has been fomenting for quite a while now. This didn't pop up just 2 years ago. It's been coming on for a long time due to the greed and the corruption of Wall Street and due to the deregulation that the Republicans foisted upon us. They can talk about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac all they want to, and yes, those were problems. But the tremendous leveraging that took place on Wall Street by some of these investment firms, that when they deregulated them and the FEC allowed them to go from 8 to 1 leveraging all the way up to 40 to 1, they went nuts. They went absolutely nuts. Their lust for greed and corruption, that went crazy on Wall Street. And that's how we arrived at where we're at today. All these financial instruments that they've dreamed up, many of them have turned out to be worthless. Naturally, the neocons trying to push it back upon the public. Well, they never should have bought these houses if they couldn't afford them. Oh, yeah. And that, while in many cases that might be true, but it isn't the primary reason this whole thing happened. The subprime mortgage isn't the only reason this happened. It was that desire for greed by the people on Wall Street. And don't try and convince me of anything different. Who was it I heard trying to convince us on TV the other night that this is a Clinton? No, a Democratic Congress. The Democratic Congress started all this. Who was it that said that on TV the other night? It's just absolutely laughable. And actually, believe it or not, the reporters on there did laugh at him. Who was it? I can't remember. But naturally, it's going to go back and forth, and everybody's going to try and blame everybody else. But we're at the point that we do need something done, and Barack Obama says help is on the way. I believe him. I wouldn't believe anybody that says this misery is going to be over with in a short period of time. I believe we're all going to have to suffer for quite a while. I would be very surprised if you and I and the rest of us average folks saw anything different to happen in our lives, an uptick in our economic situation, if you will, before the end of this coming year, or even a little halfway through the following year. I'd be very surprised and pleased if I saw any kind of an uptick after that. That would be a very good thing. And I believe that if Barack Obama and his new economic team can get this thing turned around in the first term, in 4 years, if they can get this thing turned around and get this economic train of the United States of America back on the track and back on course again, if they can do that in 4 years, I believe it would be a miracle. I do. Do I believe they can do it? Yes, I do. I think we have to believe that they'll pull it off. We have to. After all, confidence is something that they can't do this without our confidence. And I don't have to tell any of you listening right now that there is no confidence in the present administration, this lame duck administration that's in. There hasn't been any confidence in them for a good long time now. And even our neocon listeners will admit to that, that they haven't had any real confidence in this administration for some time, especially on the economic front. No confidence at all. And after all, what is the United States of America without confidence? Confidence in our leaders, confidence in ourselves, confidence that we will be able to have jobs, we'll be able to have income, we'll be able to have some sort of retirement benefits, that we'll be able to have some sort of Social Security to take care of us in our old age. We need that confidence. Without it, we're dead. It's one of the reasons things are difficult right now. There is no confidence, and why should there be? There's nothing to have confidence in right now, but we've got a bold new leader and a new team stepping into Washington on the 20th of January. Too bad it can't be tomorrow, because God knows a lot of financial devastation can take place between now and January the 20th. A lot. Henry Paulson is going to do everything he can to spend the rest of that bailout money before January the 20th. He originally said just a week ago that he would not, that he would leave the rest of it for the Obama team to take care of. Well, he's changed his mind in just 1 week, and he decided to go ahead and let's get rid of it anyway. Here's going to be one of the problems for the Obama folks. We've already borrowed close to the max from China because China's getting in trouble themselves, not going to be able to loan us any more money. So that's going to be out. And the other thing is, Paulson pretty much admitted today, they're just going to start the presses and they're going to print money. They're going to print money till hell won't have it, till he has enough to dole out as much as he wants. And I don't know how much that is. I don't know if that's $2 trillion. I don't know if that's $3 trillion. No one knows how much it is that he wants to pass out. Most of it going to banks and investors, which I feel is wrong. I think they headed into this at exactly from the wrong angle. Should have gone at it from the very beginning to help the people, not the banks. If the people are okay, the banks will be okay. Right? If the people in America are on sound footing, if their mortgages are affordable, if they've got their jobs, if they got all that, the banks will do fine. The credit card companies will do fine. The investment companies will do fine if the people, especially the middle class, because as sure as I'm sitting here, they can say what they want to about General Motors. And I believe that to be true, that old saying is General Motors goes, so goes America, because the reason is to put millions of people to work. And so as the working middle class goes, so goes America. This isn't anything about class warfare. This is just telling you how it is. As the middle class, the working middle class of America goes, so goes America. And so Paulson's going to start up those printing presses. My cousin used to be in charge of those printing presses. Treasurer of the United States during the Clinton administration, Mary Ellen Withrow, is my cousin, in fact, and I've told you that before. And I was able to learn a lot about the mint and what they do there. The Treasurer of the United States, not the Secretary of the Treasury, but the Treasurer is in charge of the Bureau of Engraving and Printing in Fort Knox and the Federal Reserve Banks. Interesting to sit down and talk about all that. But just responsible for the mechanics and the running of those situations, not about spending the money. That's up to the Secretary of the Treasury, whose office is just down the hall from the Treasurer, from one corner of the building to the Treasury building to the other. And so Paulson has decided that he's just going to start those presses and just going to print money, print money, print money. And that's going to bail us out of this. How many of you have taken Econ 101? Raise your hands. Very many of you? Quite a few. And Econ 101, you learn about this thing called inflation. You even learn about something called hyperinflation. And when you start the presses without anything to back them up, I'm not talking about the gold standard here, but when you start printing money and there's no GDP, no economic basis, no foundation to back up that money, and you print money and print money and print money, you're going to have that old wheelbarrow situation where it takes you a wheelbarrow load of $20 bills to buy a loaf of bread. That's exactly what will happen if they start printing money because they can't borrow anymore. Now, as I understand it, our credit standing around the world is still good. The dollar is still good. The dollar is still the measure that everybody looks to. But if we go further on down this trail, that's not going to be the case. We will lose our credit standing amongst the world, and when we do that, there's going to be hell to pay, not just for us, but for those who have lent us money as well. I didn't want to get off on an econ lesson here today because I'm not qualified to give one. But when I hear the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States saying that what he's going to do is just print enough money to get us through this, I know that, well, that'll be a nice little thing for the first few weeks, printing money to pay the bills. It's no different than going out and charging a bunch of stuff on a credit card when you don't have enough money to pay the credit card. That's exactly what the federal government's going to do. They're going to print money, print money, print money, and the next thing you know, a loaf of bread is going to be $10. That will happen. They're putting off the inevitable if they do this just by printing money. Problem being, for the Obama administration, if Paulson and them borrow all they can borrow, They take everything they can out of the Fed and print money. By the time the 20th of January rolls around, there may not be any money left for Obama to do anything. He may be in a corner. And then what? And I think the Obama team sees this. I think they see this happening. I think that is why they feel an urgency to get something done, to roll out their plans right now, to get their team in place right now so that they can establish credibility with the American public. I wish they could take office tomorrow. And I think the American public before long is going to wish they had taken office by tomorrow, a little later on down the road. I don't like what I see. And I hate to be the purveyor of doom and gloom on this program every day, but I don't like what I see ahead. I wish they could take the reins away from the Bush administration right now. God knows we have no reason whatsoever to trust a single decision anybody makes coming out of the Bush administration at this time. You can't point to anything positive that they've done in their 8 years. Very little. You might pick up a couple of things. But very, very little. So there's no reason to have any trust in these people whatsoever, and there's no reason to think that in their dying days as an administration, they won't go off half-cocked and pull off some real doozies. Paulson has been doing that, evidently with Bush's blessing. Does Bush even care? Obviously, he's given up on his legacy. He's not out promoting that, comparing himself to Winston Churchill and Abraham Lincoln anymore. He looks like a beaten man. He acts like a beaten man. Actually, felt a little bit sorry. Well, I was going to say I felt sorry for him. When he was pardoning that turkey, picture him pardoning those turkeys. God, I don't know who looks worse, him or the turkey. He doesn't look bad. And I think he knows. I think he knows in his heart of hearts. I've been wondering about that. I've asked about it. What do you think Bush thinks about where his place in history will be? I think he knows it's in the toilet now, and I think he knows there's no way to escape. And I think he knows that history will not be kind to him. Early on, when the mistakes of Iraq started showing up and the mistakes of his administration started to look like it was just rampant everywhere, mistakes everywhere, all you heard out of this administration, well, history will be kind to Mr. Bush. I think he knows now that it will not. I think he knows his name is Mutt. I think he knows that. I think he knows it'll remain so. Does he care? I don't know. I'm sure being the President of the United States and the heavy burdens that it puts on your shoulder will age any man. It certainly aged Bill Clinton. There isn't any question about that. Certainly aged Ronald Reagan, although he had a good makeup man. And so I'm sure the worries and pressures of being the chief executive here in the United States probably will age anyone, even me, if I had the job, which I wouldn't mind having it just for one reason. I'd like to have access to Air Force One. That sounds like me, doesn't it? Yes, I'd like to have access to Air Force One. I'm telling you about my cousin being the treasurer of the United States. You got to fly on this, you got to fly on that plane. So it was quite a trip. Went out and got my mail today. I was disappointed once again when I got the mail. I'm often disappointed when I get the mail. But lately, I've been looking forward to getting the mail every day. I've gone out there with confidence and a little bit of apprehension, but I've been looking forward to it. And not for the reason you might think. I didn't necessarily think anybody's going to send me a big check or anything. I mean, I do want to talk to you about that a little bit later. Where are all those big checks? I was disappointed today, once again, that I didn't get my shares of AIG and Citigroup and IndyMac and all them in the bank in the mail today. shares of all the companies that the government's bought out. I'm sure my shares will come in the mail any day now. After all, they've already been paid for. And we were told we were buying them. Didn't you hear that? We were buying them, you and me. Have you received your shares in the mail yet? They ought to be coming any day now, along with the complete list of where the bailout money is going. You know, that list that Paulson promises. Going to be very upfront and transparent with us. Let you know where every dollar of it's gone. Do you know where any of it's gone so far? I don't. Let's go out to the phone. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Yes, Guy. I want to ask you this question. Don't you think that they are purposely trying to bankrupt the country? Because the reason why I'm saying that, the Republicans never did like the New Deal programs, okay, or the safety net. And so, therefore, I think this is intentionally being done. So by the time the next president gets in office, he will have to almost either eliminate or cut a lot of social safety net programs. What do you think?
Well, one of their leaders, one of their neocon guys that's looked up to by almost every neocon Republican there is, Grover Norquist, said he wanted to get government small enough that he could drown it in a bathtub, and you know what that means. That means getting rid of every last social program there is, busting the Social Security, busting Medicare, busting it all so that they can take over and privatize everything. You're right on the money with what you're saying.
Yes, and this is also why it disturbs me somewhat, because it seems like the Democrats go along with this to a certain extent. And the reason why I'm saying it, because a lot of them have in the past, I'm talking about Democrats, I know how the Republicans feel, is that we got to do something to reform the Social Security program, okay? But it's never, and this is what I fought the mass media for, it's never explained to the general public that both parties have dipped into the Social Security savings. If they had left it alone, it would be solving right now.
Let us know how much money's been borrowed out of the Social Security fund. I mean, it's an astronomical amount of money.
Yes, it has.
And you're right. You're right. Both sides have done it.
Yes, they have. And therefore, that's why there's a shortfall. They try to give that impression that Social Security is not paying for itself. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That is more or less like a drag on the economy, which isn't.
It might be something that eventually, if the rates aren't raised a little bit, that it might not stand on its own. But if it hadn't been cleaned out by taking so much money out of it, it would certainly last a long, long time more than they're forecasting right now.
That's my point right there, yes. And also, I have a little problem with Obama. And the reason why I'm saying that, President-elect Obama, because he always talks about the middle class, but he's never spoken about the working class and the poor, you understand? And they are in much more dire straits than the middle class are. You got people who have to make a choice every day whether to buy some food or pay rent. They don't have no medical care or anything like that, right? Whereas the middle class do have a little bit of support, but when you go below the ladder of the socioeconomic ladder, they absolutely have none. And I don't hear him speaking on that.
Well, I'm not so sure you don't hear it. I think you have to maybe listen a little more.
Okay.
And I'm not disagreeing with you entirely, but when a politician goes out and speaks, he speaks to the largest number of ears that he can reach. And the largest number of ears he can reach is through the middle class. Now, I think we all know that when the middle class flourishes, the poor have also got it better. There's more jobs available. There are fewer people in the poor class. And
right.
Of course, a lot of us from the middle class have transferred into the poor class here lately.
Right.
So and so there's a lot of us that still consider ourselves middle class here, but we're not.
Right.
And so we're listening. And I don't believe for a minute that Barack Obama, especially considering where he came from.
Okay.
Think about where he came from. Think about what he's been doing almost all of his working life. He's been a community organizer. He hasn't been out there organizing upper middle class. I mean, he'd been organizing poor folks.
Right.
And so I have to think that in his heart, That is something that stays with him every single day. That is something that guides him, and I think that is something that you will see, that this man has great compassion for the poor. I know he does.
But tell me another thing, too. Don't you think our problem also is that exploding defense budget? It seems like there's somebody got to be strong enough. A leader has to come out to say, this is it, as far as defense spending is concerned. Because we have about 600 or 700 bases overseas. We support NATO and all those other places, okay? And I think time has come for us to get out of South Korea and get out of Japan and let these countries start supporting themselves.
I absolutely agree with that. I absolutely agree with you. When it comes to the point where our defense budget is as much as the next, 45 nations on Earth?
Yeah.
That's nuts. It's completely nuts.
It is.
Do you have any experience in buying military hardware?
No, I do not.
Okay, then let's use you as an example. You don't have any experience in it. You don't know
right. You
don't know how much a M1A tank cost or a F whatever 20 airplane now, and I don't either.
Right.
But I'll bet you I could send you into the Pentagon and you could start slashing things that we don't need. I bet you could cut it by 25% in a matter of a year. I'll bet you could.
Yes, I could.
You bet you could.
Because there's so much wasteful spending that's going on, right? And there's program. And see, the next thing we got to do is curtail these generals and admirals who always like to have new toys. You understand?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. And that's our problem right there. And our problem is also with our congressmen and senators who love the defense expenditure so they can look good and get reelected the next time.
Well, and where do a lot of these admirals and generals go after they get out of the military? They go to the military
industry.
They certainly do, and that's why they've had their little pet projects. It's an incestuous relationship, and it's something that needs to be stopped.
And I read, you remember when Reagan was in there, and he spent over $40 billion in a Star Wars project?
Mm-hmm.
And nothing came out of it. It was just wasting money.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's too much waste, especially in the defense industry that goes on in our government. And since everybody is getting the part of the fat right there, there's really nobody in our leadership, political leadership, that really wants to do anything about it.
Oh, yeah, I agree. You should write a book today. You're hot. You're hitting it all. Yeah, these defense contractors, they depend on that fat, and they depend on their connections in Washington. And how many of these I'm trying to think of a word for these fairy tale plots that they come through with they're going to build this weapon and that weapon, things that never come to fruition, that they spend billions of dollars and huge cost overruns, and only because they've got the legislators and the people in the Pentagon in their back pocket. Everybody knows
that is so true. And what do you think Americans, the general public, will ever wake up to that fact?
Well, it's because, I don't know, where do you live?
I live in a place called Uniontown, Pennsylvania.
Hey, I've been to Uniontown.
Oh, have you? Okay.
Well, of course, south of Washington, there a little ways, and I know Uniontown.
Okay.
What's the name of that famous? All of a sudden, I can't think of his name. Famous architect. That's got a.
Oh yes. Oh, I can't think of.
I can't think of.
Because he built the house that he's known for.
Out there on the rock.
Right, I'm not for sure right now.
Out on the rock. It's on a built part of the rock. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, Uniontown, a good old blue collar working town.
Yes, exactly.
Is Jack Murtha your congressman?
Yes,
Well, see,
he's part of Fayette County. He's part of, not all of it, but just part of it.
Well, see, everybody likes their own congressman, and you know, when I lived back in Ohio, I've got a congressman here that's a redder than red neocon Republican, so I don't like him. But you know, everybody says, well, my congressman, he spent a lot of money on defense, but you know, he's my congressman, and he's done a lot for my community, and I'll reelect him and all that. Those guys get immune to that after a while, and they don't, a billion here, a billion there, like they say, and pretty soon it adds up to real money. When you were younger, you're obviously a lot younger than I am, but when you were a kid, did you even know what came after a billion?
No.
A trillion, I mean, it boggles my mind.
Yes. Okay, because right now they say they have spent about, what, $7.8 trillion now?
Yeah.
In trying to shore up the economy?
Mm-hmm. Where'd it go?
That's a good question.
Have you seen any boom taking place in Uniontown? Have you seen the banks loosening up on credit? Can you buy a house, a car, get a credit card, anything right now? No.
No. And I believe this has been done purposely, so when the next president comes into office, his hands are almost going to be tied.
And if he doesn't clean everything up, they'll run against him the next time and say, hey, see, he didn't fix this. He said he would, and he didn't fix it. And they'll work against him for 4 years. They say, you know, they're going to have the spirit of bipartisanship right now. You know they won't.
I know. Because you already can hear Sean Kennedy and Rush Limbaugh and that ilk already scrutinize him and flaunting him for every little thing there is right now.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not even in the office yet.
Yeah.
I think that's a darn shame how they're trying to poison a lot of people's mind against him. You understand?
Oh, it's just, the first day or two after the election was over, they ate a little bit of crow. And I heard Hannity say, well, he's my president, and I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt on everything until he proves me otherwise. And it wasn't 2 days later he was sticking a knife in Barack Obama and twisting it. So,
I know. That's so true. Well, okay, Guy, it was nice talking to you, and keep up the good job.
Hey, thanks for calling from good old Uniontown.
Okay, bye.
Bye now. That's America right there. Uniontown, Pennsylvania, you betcha. I started saying that, and I can't stop. I've got the you betcha disease. Uniontown, Pennsylvania, that's America. Blue collar, hard working, a lot of immigrants. That's the way I see America, through Uniontown, Pennsylvania type eyes. I didn't live in a place like that. I was born and raised in farm country. But that's a part of America that's changed tremendously. The jobs gone away, and that whole area over there in Pennsylvania is troubled right now. You're listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Ben Fischel. Our top item today, several media outlets are now advancing false claims that union auto workers make an average $70 per hour in an argument which seeks to blame the workers for the auto industry's financial straits. Here's Todd Harris on MSNBC.
First of all, they don't make $25 an hour. They make a heck of a lot more than that.
This is the first time I've really heard anybody blame the guy making $25 or $30 or even $35 an hour for the economic collapse on Wall Street. And I
or $75 an hour.
However, the often repeated $70-plus figure is wildly exaggerated. It includes all costs of labor, including retirees' pensions and health care costs. The average figure is actually closer to $28 per hour. But today's most outrageous comment goes to talk radio host Michael Savage on same-sex marriage.
At least in Weimar Germany, men couldn't marry men, and women couldn't marry women. So we're probably 10 leagues below the degeneracy that brought about Hitler.
For these stories and more, visit MediaMatters.org.
Yeah.
jogged my brain a little bit just at the end of that tune. Are you like me, as scatterbrained, and you can't think of something, and all of a sudden, for no reason at all, the answer pops in your head? I was trying to think who I saw on TV talking about how this was an Obama recession, a Democratic Congress recession, an Obama recession. It was that idiot Grover Norquist. Yeah. It's because, you see, that the people on Wall Street, according to Grover Norquist, saw that Obama was coming in. Therefore, they figured he was going to win the election, and so, therefore, they lost all their confidence in our economy. And that is why the market has gone all to hell, according to Grover Norquist. Why do people keep listening to him? Why is that? Why do they listen to people like him and Dick Armey, by the way, who has a Ph.D. in economics, former House Minority Leader, and Tom DeLay and Newt Gingrich? And your Sean Hannitys and your Dick Moore, why do people listen to them? I think it's so funny that Dick Morris has been caught red-handed. I can't think of the name of the organization now. Another one of those names, oh, we're patriotic and you're not type organizations, that he's been getting money from, and he's made it sound like some Republican think tank or something that's out for donations, and he's been plugging them on Fox, telling people to donate, and here he's been siphoning money off of it himself, and he's been caught. Now, will Fox show any ethics whatsoever and get rid of him? Will Rupert Murdoch stand for that, to have Dick Morris on his show begging for money and then sticking some of it in his pocket? Would anybody stand for that? I guess if anybody would, it would be Rupert Murdoch and Fox News. So we'll see. That just happened yesterday, I think, that they found out about it, and it was all over the news last night. But I did like what Oberman said last night. He said something about he connected Dick Morris and the prostitutes there. Why does the media leave that alone? You've got one of the freakiest, most weird fellows that I think I've ever heard of. His particular situation with the prostitutes in one Dick Morris. A bitter, bitter man. You know Dick Morris, who I'm talking about, talks out of the side of his mouth all the time. Mean, nasty, vindictive man. Hates the Clintons because they tossed his ass out of the White House. And as well, he should have been tossed out. Because Dick Morris is a weasel of the highest. And I'm ashamed of the fact that Clinton had anything to do with him in the first place. And he's even shown in these past few months, as has Karl Rove, that he's all that not that much of a political guru either. I think Rove might have had us all fooled. Dick Morris certainly had Bill Clinton fooled. But Oberman last night kind of put it to Dick Morris. And I thought, yeah, do it, go for it. Because he is a weasel. 866-546-5254. Found this quote by Thomas Jefferson. I've seen it before, but it was good to be reminded of it. A quote by Thomas Jefferson in 1802. Talk about foresight. Thomas Jefferson, possibly as much of a Renaissance man as anybody that ever lived in this country, I believe. Man far ahead of his time. Not without faults. A lot of times we look at our forefathers, some of them, like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and John Adams and some of them, like they were pure as the driven snow, and they weren't. But Thomas Jefferson wrote, "I believe," and I quote, "I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies. If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around the banks will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered." End quote. Thomas Jefferson, 1802. Was he on the money or not? Was he 2,006 years or 206 years ahead of his time or not? I think he was right on it. Right on it. Wow. Such as Dwight Eisenhower was right on the money when he said, beware the military-industrial complex when he left office. He knew exactly what he was talking about. He'd been embroiled in that. He'd seen the evils of it. He'd seen what it did to the Treasury of the United States. He'd seen what the lobbying community grew up around it, the military-industrial complex. It grew into this behemoth that nobody could control. Dwight Eisenhower had the foresight to see that. And 206 years ago, Thomas Jefferson could see that banks without controls were dangerous to America. And you talk about without controls. Do you know people all over this country now are getting statements from their credit card companies saying, oh, we're going to raise your interest? Three different people in email today told me that they'd gotten statements from their credit card company saying the credit card company, not because they defaulted or not because they'd missed a payment or been late or anything like that. Evidently it says, and I've, just as guilty as many people, never really read one of those contracts. Evidently it says in there that they can raise their interest as much as they want to, any time they want to. And so, despite having been bailed out of billions of dollars by our funds, these parasites, these leeches, are going to raise everybody's, not everybody's, but anybody they can, their credit card rates. Well, that's what Thomas Jefferson was talking about. That's exactly what he was talking about, although I don't know that he could foresee the plastic industry, runaway plastic industry that we've got now, credit card companies. But in 1802, Thomas Jefferson could see that if the American people ever allowed private banks to control the issue of their currency, the banks and corporations that will grow up around the banks will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered. Couldn't be more true. Couldn't be more true. Wow. I see, for those of you that love to watch the stock market, it's up 211 points today. On what basis would that be? Why, it's because Mr. Paulson has said he's going to throw a bunch more money their way. Man, I'll tell you that last night and tonight, and probably every night for a while people are losing their homes, while people are losing their pensions, while people are losing their jobs, those $100 cigars and $15 drinks on Wall Street will be enjoyed by the fat cats on Wall Street. Now, I talk a lot about them, and I don't want to make them a scapegoat. I wouldn't do that if they weren't guilty of it. And I think we've seen the excess by the fat cats on Wall Street until everybody's sick of it. And I believe that maybe it's tonight. I don't know what night it's going to be on, but there's an interview. Maybe it was last night. I don't know. I didn't see it if it was on last night. An interview by Barbara Wawa and interviewing Barack Obama. I saw a clip of it, and he was asked whether or not the bankers, fat cat bankers, should take bonuses this year, and he said no. I agree with him. If your company hasn't turned a great profit this year, if your company hasn't been ultra successful this year, you don't deserve a bonus. I don't care what kind of a business you're in. Any Christmas bonuses usually passed out were part of the profits for the year. And if there were no profits, why on earth, other than maybe a Thanksgiving turkey, Why would anybody get anything from their employer if there were no profits for the year? From the people that ran it and made the decisions that ran it into the ground. that ran the big three automakers into the ground for now. And Lehman Brothers. And Citigroup. And WaMu. And IndyMac. And the list goes on and on and on. Why would any of those people deserve anything? Changing the subject a bit, I see that the war is still on in Minnesota. Is Al Franken going to end up winning that thing or not? I don't think so, but a few people are predicting that he will by the ever so slightly margin, slight margin of just a few votes. I don't know. But I don't think Franken and the Democrats are going to allow him to get away with what happened in Florida in the year 2000. And whatever it takes to get an accurate count, I believe you're going to see happen in the state of Minnesota. I certainly hope so. And, of course, that's going to mean that the December 2nd election, that's coming up, what, next week? December 2nd in Georgia. I see all the big boys are coming in on both sides. Saxby Chambliss is bringing in Sarah Palin. I can't think of any place she'd be more effective than in Georgia or South Carolina, perhaps, and Tennessee and Alabama and Mississippi and Louisiana and Arkansas and Texas. She'd be real popular in those places. So I guess it's probably a good move to bring her in. But everybody from the Democratic Party is heading down to support Martin in Georgia. And the polls are running very, very close on that. It's just a couple of points as we speak. And you get Bill Clinton down there, and I don't think the Democrats will be sending Joe Lieberman anytime soon. But it will be interesting. And I tell you what, regardless how that thing turns out, I mean, I would love so much to see Saxby Chambliss defeated. I would be so pleased. The way he ran his first campaign, first time around, was despicable and disgusting. It was. But I really don't know why the Democrats are all hung up on this 60-vote thing. I've talked about it. Everybody's talked about it. Well, if we get Franken in and we get Martin in, we'll have 60. No, we won't. We'd have 60 if Harry Reid could round up 60 every time a vote comes up or if an appointment comes up that they want to push through. I mean, yes, it would help to have 60, but that's not an ironclad done deal if we get 60. That doesn't mean the likes of a Lieberman and a Nelson and Salazar and all that. That doesn't mean some of those people won't vote the other way. Mary Landrieu, perhaps. It's going to be, to corral 60 Democrats. If we end up with 60 in the Senate, if Harry Reid could get all 60 of them to vote on the same thing at the same time, it'd be a miracle. Republicans can do that. They get their majority or minority leader right now, McConnell. He's had them stand firm, rock solid, how many times so far? Almost every time he needed him to. Harry Reid hasn't, and he won't. Now, if we end up with 60 and we lose a couple on a vote, like a Nelson from Nebraska or Lieberman or somebody like a Mary Landrieu, we lose somebody like that in a vote, maybe we can pick off some Republicans. Maybe we can pick off an Olympia Snow or a Collins or an Arlen Specter or maybe even a Corker or a McCain. Who knows? But they're really playing politics of the highest order with this. I would love to see us end up with the 60, but don't be misled by all that. If we end up with 60, don't think that everything comes up that we need 60 for that we're going to get, because that's getting 60 Democratic senators to all vote the way you want to. That's like trying to herd some ducks. And it doesn't work out very well sometimes. We'll see. We will see. 866-546-5254. When we come back, want to talk a little bit about Thanksgiving. What are you going to do for Thanksgiving? I know what I'm doing for Thanksgiving. And maybe we'll talk a little bit about the history of Thanksgiving and all that. Got two Yorkie puppies, and I wonder, will they get anything special for Thanksgiving? I guess I have to ask my wife about that. What do you think? Are the puppies going to get anything special for Thanksgiving? She says yes. Okay. you know, a piece of turkey or something. They, you know, as how many of your dog lovers? Very many? Quite a few. Okay. Those puppies can look at you a certain way that I was down at the vet one time and took a look at our oldest Yorkie, Kukla. And the vet looked at me and said, how can you ever say no to a face like that? And it's so true. So true. Yeah, Powerpuff on the chat room. She's right. Pups will get a treat on Thanksgiving. But if you feel so inclined, after the break, we'll be stopping for news here in just a moment. For some people's pensions and so forth, I hope it's good for you. Hope it's something very, very positive for you. And I do want to talk a little bit, coming back from when we come back from the break, about how Bush might be calling the Democrats bluff on some of the stuff about the torture and not pardoning people. I think he might be engaging a little bit of that, just kind of daring the Democrats to go after anybody that was involved in any of this torture business. So we're going to pause for news right now, coming up at the top of the hour. We'll be back in just a couple minutes.
Listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. With the candidates in a statistical dead heat in the polls, labor is working feverishly to win the Georgia U.S. Senate runoff election December 2nd. Still battling to get Democrats their 60-vote filibuster-proof U.S. Senate majority, Stuart Acuff is running the AFL-CIO's election effort in Georgia.
Organized labor is running full tilt. We intend to touch 325,000 union members and family members at least six times, and in some cases as many as 10 times.
Acuff says labor can win this based on economic issues.
We're very confident that working families in Georgia are going to put Jim Martin in the U.S. Senate. A regular guy, a stand-up guy, a guy just as easy to talk to as you or I, who knows and understands us and who cares about the challenges that working families face every day.
Over the next 2 years, President-elect Barack Obama is pledging to create 2.5 million new jobs. He laid out how he hopes to achieve that goal during his weekly address on YouTube. Jesse Russell reports.
In March of 1933, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt began his first in a series of fireside chats intended to bring comfort to Americans struggling through the Great Depression and also to bolster support for his New Deal. In the 80s, President Ronald Reagan started a new tradition of weekly Saturday addresses that have continued until today. President-elect Barack Obama is taking the next great leap with a weekly online video address. This past weekend, he used this new platform to lay out his goal of creating 2.5 million jobs over the first 2 years of his presidency.
We'll put people back to work rebuilding our crumbling roads and bridges, modernizing schools that are failing our children, and building wind farms and solar panels, fuel-efficient cars, and the alternative energy technologies that can free us from our dependence on foreign oil and keep our economy competitive in the years ahead.
225,000 New Yorkers could lose their jobs over the next 2 years as Wall Street contracts.
That number was released by State Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli on Monday. DiNapoli said part of the problem was an overpaying of employees during the first half of 2008. 97% of net revenues went toward compensation. Next year, we'll likely see 38,000 jobs cut in the security sector. Millions of workers worldwide are expected to see pay cuts in the coming year due to the global financial crisis. That's according to a new report from the UN's International Labor Organization. The ILO says difficult times lie ahead for the world's 1.5 billion wage earners. The report says middle classes around the world, as well as the poor, will feel the pain.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Throw the second switch! Throw the third switch!
Not the third switch!
Throw it, I say! Throw it!
The Guy James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Fly! Fly, you hear me? Give my creation! Fly!
So this was fun.
You're going to like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Good countdown. Six. Five, four, three, two, one.
You have entered the restricted broadcast area. You have entered the restricted broadcast area.
This is the Guy James Show. The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. Thank you for joining us today. Guess I better turn down the volume on this monitor here. Ooh, getting a little bit of an echo there. 866-546-5254, if you'd like to join us here in the Guy James Show. I want to talk a little bit about Thanksgiving this afternoon. What will you be doing for Thanksgiving? What do you have to be thankful for this Thanksgiving? Somebody sent me a funny little note of things to be thankful for. And it came from the folks over at the Progress Report. Things to be thankful for this Thanksgiving. So we're thankful. We'll soon have a president who will hit the ground running instead of a president who is running the country into the ground. Well, we're thankful that Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow are demonstrating every night how strong and intelligent progressive voices can be successful on TV. And I might add the Head On Radio Network here on radio. We're thankful we live in a center-left America rather than Hannity's America. We're thankful John McCain has more time to spend in the houses he owns, even if he can't remember them all. We're thankful Sarah Palin has more time to watch over Russia and warn us in case Vladimir Putin ever rears his head. We're thankful that we're moving closer toward a complete withdrawal from Iraq. We're thankful for the thousands of protesters who took to the streets across America to push for marriage equality. We're not thankful for neo-McCarthy's, neo-Hoover's, neo-Nazis, and neo-cons. We're thankful for Tina Fey. We're thankful to be liberal hacks. We're not thankful for hack operatives burrowing into career civil service jobs. We're more thankful for Vice President Joe Biden and Morning Joe than Joe Lieberman and Joe the Plumber. We're thankful that our troops will be able to get the education they so richly deserve. We're thankful for the mustache of justice, Rambo, Axe, and Skippy. I'm afraid they lost me on that one. We're thankful that reality still has a liberal bias. We're thankful that there are only 55 days left until the end of George W. Bush's presidency, and we're thankful for the progressive mandate to govern. Yes, indeed, I can go along with all of those things. We are indeed thankful for that. Black Friday coming up. You got your shopping shoes ready? I've talked to a lot of people who said, no way, no how are they going to go out and do any shopping on Black Friday this year. It'll be interesting to see what kind of a day the merchants say they had. Will they tell the truth? Who knows? The original Thanksgiving Day. Would you be surprised if you were told that they may not have had turkey on Thanksgiving Day, what to consider? And there are many arguments about when the first Thanksgiving Day might be. There are people that would argue that it took place in Florida at St. Augustine. There are people who would argue that it took place in Texas. You can say, how can that be? It wasn't part of America. Well, neither was Plymouth Rock. These are all places in Florida and Texas that were controlled more or less by the Spanish, but later became part of America. So there are arguments that when the first actual Thanksgiving took place. But the only written eyewitness account of the first Thanksgiving dinner was a letter written by colonist Edward Winslow to his friend in England in late 1621. And history scholars have scoured the correspondence to try to accurately forge an account of the true Thanksgiving meal. The vision of the feast, this letter in history form, is far from how it is traditionally replicated in modern America. Foods that were not served at the first Thanksgiving. Turkey. Turkey was often eaten by both the Wampanoag, and I'm killing that name, and the Pilgrims, the Indians, and the Pilgrims, but is not specifically mentioned in Winslow's letter. The account mentions wild fowl only and could have referred to duck or geese instead of wild turkey. Popcorn. There was no popcorn. Corn was prevalent, but it was not popped. Cranberry sauce. 50 years after 1621, there is mention of a cranberry sauce for use with meat in English recipes. Prior to this time, sugar, a necessary ingredient in cranberry sauce, was an incredibly expensive import. Both the Pilgrims and the Wampanoag would add whole cranberries as an ingredient to add tartness. However, cranberry sauce itself would not appear until the 1670s. Potatoes. White potatoes were virtually unknown in England at the time of the Thanksgiving feast. They were only raised by specialized botanists at the time and were not a part of the English diet. Sweet potatoes were. In the early 1600s, they were imported into England from Spain and were used only by the ultra-wealthy for their purported aphrodisiac properties. Pumpkin pie. There were no readily available ingredients for the crust of a pumpkin pie at the time. Pumpkin and squash were included in the feast, but served as vegetables only. After 1621, pumpkin dessert recipes included pumpkin pieces sliced similar to apples only. Apples. Apples were not present in 1621 in Plymouth. So there you go. No turkey, no cranberry sauce, no potatoes, no pumpkin pie, no apples. Fish included. Food that were included in the original Thanksgiving feast. In addition to the wild fowl, pumpkin, and squash mentioned above, the following foods were certainly abundant and most likely were included in the harvest celebration. Fish, lobsters, eel, mussels, oysters, corn, parsnip, collards, turnips, spinach, onions, dried beans, dried blueberries, grapes, and nuts. And the meal in 1621, the Thanksgiving meal, the celebration lasted for 3 days, not one, and it consisted of intermittent feasting and entertainment, games and shooting of muskets, and it was most likely held in October, not November, and there is no evidence that the Indians were explicitly invited. It was not called Thanksgiving, it was a harvest festival, and it did not become an annual event. And to quote Edward Winslow, he said, "By the goodness of God, we are so far from want that we often wish you partakers of our plenty." Edward Winslow, December 11th, 1621. Surprised me a little bit when I read that, all the foods that they did not have at the first Thanksgiving. Another little story that links up to that. U.S. tradition compares the holiday meal with the meal held in 1621 by the Indians and the Puritans who settled in Plymouth, Massachusetts. And the element continues in modern times with the Thanksgiving dinner, often featuring turkey, playing a large role in the celebration of Thanksgiving. And certainly when we're talking about turkey, the turkeys we have today bear no resemblance to the turkey people were eating in early times, even though they didn't really have one at the first. We don't know that for a fact. But if there weren't any turkeys running around like you eat today. These turkeys today have been bred to be freaks, really. In the United States, certain kinds of foods are traditionally served at Thanksgiving meals. First and foremost, baked or roast turkey is the featured item, and stuffing and mashed potatoes and gravy and sweet potatoes and cranberry sauce and sweet corn and other fall vegetables and pumpkin pie. But there are many myths about Thanksgiving that I'm not sure a lot of people know about. You've all heard about the tryptophan in turkey, how it makes you sleepy, right? Actually, researchers are not sure how that gained wide acceptance. The urban legend is that the tryptophan in turkey is what makes you sleepy on Thanksgiving. Yes, the amino acid tryptophan is present in turkey, and in certain doses, it can make you sleepy. But in reality, you'd need to eat an entire 40-pound turkey to get enough tryptophan to make a difference. So that's one of the myths. So why do people take a nap on the couch? It's probably due to alcohol, or it could be that you got up early in the morning to travel, or it's been a long, beautiful day and you're just tired. I hate to even mention this, but I've seen claims that because you're increasing your carbohydrates, you're increasing your blood sugar. Maybe this could lead to sleepiness, but I'm not sure I agree with that. Are there really ways to do an okay diet, diet-wise on a day of turkey, stuffing, and pies? Yes. You should really have breakfast in the morning. A lot of people think, well, I'm going to eat this big Thanksgiving meal, and they skip breakfast. I think I've been guilty of that myself. Eat slow. Don't gobble it all down. You know how that goes. It takes about 20 minutes for you're being told that you're getting full, so keep that in mind. So there are some things that we need to know about Thanksgiving. How are you going to celebrate Thanksgiving tomorrow? With a lot of people, just a few of you? Anybody celebrate it alone? 866-546-5254. 866-546-5254. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Don't go away.
Baby, when I met you, there was peace unknown. I said,
Islands in the Stream. You're listening to the Guy James Show here on the Hit On Radio Network. I'm glad to have you all with us today. I was talking to a friend of mine that wrote a great piece for Thanksgiving, and I would like to tell you about this piece. In fact, I'd like to read it for you and make a few comments along the way. I'm talking about Sarah Robinson over at OurFuture.org. As you know, we go there every year for the Take Back America Conference. I don't know if we'll call it that this coming year, Campaign for America's Future. And anyway, Sarah wrote this really great summary of Talking Turkey, 10 Myths Conservatives Believe About Progressives. I think it's one of the best pieces I've read in a long, long time, and I'd like to present it to you. It is that time again, Thanksgiving, the official kickoff of the 2008 holiday season. And as you prepare to head once again into the family fray to spend quality time with your conservative relatives, it helps to note that most of the right wing's favorite anti-liberal slanders are rooted in some deeply held and deeply wrong assumptions about who liberals are and what we believe. Your best defense is to listen closely for those underlying myths and fables at work and be prepared to challenge them head on. And here's how. It's the kickoff of the 2008 holiday season. For a lot of progressives, Thanksgiving, these festivities also mean that we're about to spend more quality time with our conservative relatives over the next 6 weeks and then is strictly good for our blood pressure, stress levels, or continued sanity. Personally, I'm not a wholehearted fan of turkey, probably because the mere smell of it instantly slams me back into memories of several decades of Thanksgiving dinner arguments with conservative kin that took a turn for the ugly. We all know we're supposed to stick to safe topics like the kids, college football, and the weather, and avoid controversial issues like religion and politics and whether oysters belong in a proper bird stuffing, but the afternoon is long. And after the approved topics have been exhausted, and that third bottle of Cabernet vanishes, and the tryptophan tuper hits, decorum and discipline are at high risk of going all to hell. After that, things can, and do, get contentious, usually in ways that make everyone wish we could just all go back to fighting over oysters and the stuffing. The family gatherings were hard enough to stomach through the appalling years of the Bush adoration, but this year, it's likely to be even worse. Our beloved family wingnuts were insufferable in a grotesque, Mayberry-on-acid surreal kind of way, while crowing into their succotash about the manly godliness, or was it the godly manliness, of our divinely ordained commander-in-chief. But this year's different. This year, they're on their way out of power. And they're scared witless about it, which means big steaming heaping helpings of liberal bashing are likely to be featured prominently on the menu next to the mashed potatoes as they put fresh vigor into every paranoid anti-liberal fantasy ever spouted by Rush, Reverend Pat, or their new darling, Sarah Palin. A black guy won. Armageddon. Or, at the very least, socialism, atheism, gun control, and a national epidemic of erectile dysfunction may certainly be at hand. And as you prepare to head once again into the family fray, it might be useful to note that most of the right-wing's favorite anti-liberal slanders are rooted in some deeply held and deeply wrong assumptions about who liberals are and what we believe, and if your relatives, God bless them all, insist on going down that road, your best defense this year might be to listen closely for these underlying myths and fables at work and hit them head on, like we said before. And here's the basic set to get you started. Tuck it away with your bag of in your bag with your Xanax and your Maalox, and apply liberally, of course, as needed. Number one, liberals hate America. For the record, liberals love America. In fact, what makes us liberals is that we actually read and believed all those pretty words in the Declaration of Independence about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and in the Bill of Rights about freedom of speech and religion and assembly and privacy and all the rest of it. We're idealists that way. We want to live in the country the founders described. We believe that the nation's founding documents expressed a uniquely powerful moral contract between the people and their government, and an audaciously positive vision of people's ability and the competence to shape their own future. When we get annoying and whiny, it's usually because we believe so much in America's astonishing promise and our own responsibility for realizing it that we're sorely disappointed when the country falls short of that standard. We really want to believe that we can do better. Conservatism, by contrast, tends to take a dim view of human nature, prefers hierarchy to liberty, and isn't completely convinced that people can or should be trying to contravene the will of God or their betters by trying to arrange their own futures. This tends to lead to a selective reading of the Constitution as well as the Bible, and, as we've seen in the Bush years, a far more flexible attitude toward its interpretation. The proof, however, is in its history and is pretty irrefutable. America's greatest moments of progress, generosity, and moral strength occurred when the country stuck most closely to its progressive ideals. We loved America so much that we freed the slaves, passed child labor laws, built schools and colleges, gave the vote to women, enacted civil rights laws, rebuilt Europe after a war we helped win, and put a man on the moon. All of these were progressive projects, and all were fought tooth and nail by conservatives in their time, simply because they feared change and saw power as a zero-sum game. Yes, we sometimes overshoot and miss, but you can't argue with the daring scope of our dreams. Conversely, most of our worst moments, the Native American genocide, the continued justification of slavery and Jim Crow, the Japanese internment, Abu Ghraib, were conservative projects that were driven by narrow-minded xenophobia and short-term greed, and are regretted by everyone, including most conservatives, when we look back now. Number two, liberals wanted to leave us defenseless in the face of evildoers around the world. The big disconnect on security issues begins with the fact that we have a far more expansive definition of security than conservatives do, and perhaps a broader sense of what the actual threats are and what can be done about them. When conservatives discuss security, they're usually thinking in terms of solving all of our problems by sending in more guys and gals with guns. The flip side of this is that they tend not to give much credence to real threats and can't be fixed by guys and gals with guns. But as progressives, we know that the country's financial crisis is a security issue, and in a world of superbugs and epidemics and universal healthcare, universal healthcare is a security issue. And global warming is, plain as day, a looming security issue. We also know that sending in the Marines, hiring more cops, and taking off our shoes at the airport won't begin to address some of our most terrifying problems. Real-world security is far more complex and requires a much wider range of solutions than most conservatives are willing to consider. Number three issue that you might explain to your relatives at Thanksgiving tomorrow, that liberals hate the free market. That's another one of their myths. If that's so, why does everyone down at the Apple store know my name? The operative word here is free. Liberals believe wholeheartedly in the amazing powers of markets to deliver all kinds of important goods. But they've also noticed that some of the deepest human goods of all, a strong family, a caring community, a healthy environment, safe food, clean water and air, and time to enjoy them are assigned no economic value at all in unfettered markets. And if we want to protect the value of things that money can't buy, and usually even conservatives will agree that such common goods exist and deserve to be protected, then we need to put some restrictions on markets so they can't encroach into these areas. Besides, any 10-year-old who's played Monopoly can tell you how free markets invariably end up. One person ends up owning the whole game board and everybody else ends up broke, game over. That's not an accident. It's just how capitalist systems work. Good regulations can go a long way toward preventing that too. Number four. Another one of the myths that we've heard, especially during these last two terms of Junior Bush, is that liberals hate our troops. We love our troops. We love them so much that we want them brought home safe and sound to their families as soon as possible. This one's almost depressingly easy. Who blocks the new GI Bill because it might encourage troops not to re-up? Who refuses to increase VA funding? Who oversaw last year's debacle at Walter Reed? Who's making soldiers buy their own body armor? Newsflash for you. It ain't the liberals. Putting a yellow ribbon decal on your car is not enough. Making sure our troops have everything they need to do their jobs and keep our promises to them when they get home is putting our money where our mouth is. Liberals have been doing this and been doing the heavy lifting on this from the start, while the conservatives in government have been nowhere on the scene unless there was a photo op involved. Number five that you might discuss, another myth put forth by the conservatives, that liberals are a bunch of elitists who hate decent working and middle-class Americans, as opposed to those sainted corporate men of the people who fly around in private jets and pull down eight-figure salaries while closing plants and cutting 10,000 jobs at a time. That's what real populism looks like. You betcha. Liberals are funny people. We think that sending well-paid American jobs overseas is a bad idea. We think the minimum wage should be big enough to cover life's necessities, with some left over. We think it's insane that over half the bankruptcies in the country are due to a lack of adequate medical insurance. We think everybody who has the grades should have a shot at college. And we believe that middle-class prosperity is absolutely essential for maintaining a healthy democracy, because history has taught us that no democracy has tolerated our current levels of inequality has ever survived for very long. You'd be surprised at how many conservatives making this accusation have never stopped and taken stock of the role government has played in making their own middle-class life possible. Their dad or granddad got through college on the GI Bill. They financed their education with Pell Grants and federally funded loans. They grew up in FHA or VA-funded houses and collected fat mortgage interest deductions, which, right there, ensured their family's place in the middle class. They went to decent public schools and perhaps state universities, and they're several thousand dollars richer every month because they're off the hook for grandma's living expenses thanks to Social Security and Medicare. They, or their parents, may have started businesses with the help of the Small Business Administration or relied on government advice and subsidies to keep the farm going. They worked for businesses that depended on government contracts. And then they'll sit there over the second helping of candied yams and loudly insist that they made everything they had all by themselves with no help from anybody, and especially not from the government. All you can do is laugh. And then, because their family, go back to 1945 and start retelling the family story, this time with Uncle Sam's forgotten role in the drama front and center. That one especially hits home with me. I hear that being, well, I pulled myself up with my bootstraps. Liberals are against family values, another myth you'll want to discuss tomorrow. This is one of the biggest disconnects between us. As George Lakoff has pointed out, conservatives and liberals have very different ideas about what families look like, about how they function, and what rules they should run under. The problem is that liberals are quite willing to recognize the conservative model as a legitimate and valid way to do family, even if we don't always agree with it. But when conservatives look at liberal families and their patchwork of made-up arrangements, they see a chaotic free-for-all that doesn't follow any of their strictly mandated rules of family organization, and thus doesn't qualify in their minds as any kind of family at all. We think it's creative and flexible. They think it's unstable and scary. So it comes as a considerable shock to conservatives when you point out that progressive areas of the country have significantly stronger families, by almost any metric you can imagine. They have lower rates of divorce, teen pregnancy, infidelity, drug abuse, domestic violence, and juvenile delinquency than the more conservative areas do. Massachusetts, the first state to offer gay marriage, also has the lowest divorce rate in the country. They like marriage so much there, they think everybody should have a shot at it. And looking at the statistics, it's possible to conclude that the conservative obsession with family values may reflect the fact that families in red America really are beset by devastating problems that aren't nearly as common in blue America. Rather than admit that maybe we know something about creating healthy families that they don't, they usually try to fix the blame for their family chaos on us and our crazy anything-goes family arrangements. And if there are Bible readers at your table, you might suggest they reread Luke 6:42 before holding forth. Liberals believe in family. We take our marriage vows just as seriously as conservatives do. We love our children just as much. Our families are at least as successful and happy as theirs. And this shouldn't be a matter of debate, but it will continue to be one, as long as they refuse to believe that our families are just as healthy, valid, and sacred to us as theirs are to them. And the seventh myth that you may want to discuss with your families tomorrow: liberals want to raise our taxes. It all depends on who is the our in this scenario. If your dinner companions are well off enough to be bringing over $250,000 a year, there's no point in finessing this. Their taxes probably are going up. The only comeback is that between Clinton-era tax cuts, the housing bubble, and the hot stock market over the past 15 years, they probably made so much money that it's time to start giving some back to the nation that made their boom possible. If nobody at the table fits that happy description, then according to Obama's plan, they're going to get a tax cut. Sure, they're not going to believe it until they see it, and quite possibly not even then. But it's not an argument that they even want to have until after an Obama tax plan is passed and the actual results are in. Remind them also that there's just no way to pay for a $600 billion war and a $700 billion bailout without somebody, somewhere, paying some more taxes. The bill for the war alone currently stands at $5,000 per American household. The bailout may cost that much again, depending on how much of the money the government can recoup. The government went shopping on her credit card, and now it's time to pay our share of the bill. The number eight myth you might want to discuss with your family tomorrow at the table. This often sounds odd. Liberals are godless and therefore immoral. Yes, it does sound odd coming from people who raise you, who generally like you, and who usually think you're a fairly sound citizen, well apart from that weird liberal thing. But one good comeback is to personalize that accusation. Do you really think I'm less moral than you are? Seriously, in what way? And if you can resist the temptation, you should say, gee, it must have been the way I was raised. Another twist on this: I'm liberal because you made me that way. You dragged me to church where they taught me to love my neighbor and care for the poor and the sick, and I became a progressive because I took the things you taught me to heart. And if personalizing the argument doesn't work with your crowd, go general. A lot of progressives are deeply religious, and our politics are guided by our religious faith. Evangelical churches are getting involved with environmentalism, poverty, and human trafficking, all issues where liberals have been active for decades. It's good to have the extra hands on board. It's also true that a lot of progressives aren't religious. Unfortunately, many conservatives equate secular with having no moral code whatsoever, since they honestly believe that nobody can possibly behave themselves unless there's some outside authority keeping a hairy eyeball on them. Rejecting God means you refuse to follow His rules, which, according to their logic, can only mean that you hold nothing sacred and don't recognize any rules at all. Call this out for the wrongness that it is. All non-religious progressives have things they hold deeply sacred. Family commitments, community to obligation, professional responsibilities, the Constitution, social and economic justice, the earth and its systems, the idea of democracy, the dream of a peaceful future. Those things form the basis of a demanding, internally driven moral code. And it's not uncommon to find secular progressives who live more uncompromisingly moral lives than many overtly religious people. Number 9 that you might want to suggest, liberals don't believe in personal responsibility. Again, there's a definitional disconnect at work here. Conservatives tend to use the rule of law to enforce traditional morality and social hierarchies, which usually means light treatment for those at the top and harsh penalties for those at the bottom. Liberals tend to use the rule of law to maintain some semblance of fairness and equality, which means that those who have more should be given sentences proportional to their greater wealth and power, and those with less should be given a more gentle hand. Naturally, each side finds the other side's reasoning and criteria appalling. But there is common ground. The bare fact, which everybody at the table may agree on, is that in present-day America, nobody is happy with the way justice is being doled out, and people all over are getting away with things no civilized nation should allow to slide by. Absurd leniency abounds on both sides, and you can either argue over whose side is getting the worst of it, or you can simply agree that the system is broken all over and move on to the pumpkin pie. The number 10 myth that you may want to talk about. Conservatives like to characterize liberals as being soft in all the places our society values toughness. Our refusal to adhere to any dogma must mean that we're soft in our convictions. Our reflexive open-mindedness is often derided as evidence that we're soft in the head. Our persistent and gentle insistence on humane government is evidence of hearts too soft to set hard boundaries to do what must be done. And all of this together makes it easy for them to portray us as a mushy bunch of feckless, if effeminate, intellectuals lacking a cohesion, backbone, focus, or purpose. But you can only believe this if you don't know anything about the history or reality of American liberalism. The Constitution is itself a liberal document, the ultimate expression of Enlightenment principles. In every decade since the Republic was founded, progressives have stepped up and put themselves on the line to further the purposes of government laid out in the preamble. We're heirs to the people who fought and died to free slaves, organize unions, get the vote to women, end child labor, protect family farms, enact civil rights laws, and preserve our environment. And some of the boldest, bravest Americans in history, Harriet Tubman, Susan B. Anthony, Frederick Douglass, Teddy Roosevelt, Cesar Chavez, and of course Dr. King, have proudly called themselves liberal or progressive. The grocery store. I was at the grocery store this morning. It was busy at